Hi, and welcome to Scalescape. I'm your host, Justin Chu. Today, we have Luwazi, who is currently the head of venture at Founders Factory Africa, and she's also a 2019 Obama Africa leader and two-time early-stage tech founder. Luwazi is passionate about impact investment and democratizing access to opportunity. In this episode, we dive deep into the strengths and challenges of venture capital in the African continent. Enjoy! Luwazi, I've been looking forward to having this conversation with you ever since our fireside chat with Felix. With our conversation, I really hope to learn more about the trends, challenges, and strengths of the African continent within the startup ecosystem, which I know you have so much to impart onto all of us today. So thank you for coming on to the show.
Hi, thank you so much for having me. This is super exciting and equally enjoyed meeting Felix and the team. And so super excited to be here. Thanks for having me.
Of course, it's my pleasure. To kick things off, what brought you into venture capital and do you see yourself doing it in the long run?
Yeah, I think that's a really good question. I think two things. I think venture capital for me has always been an industry that, living in the US for 10 years, I really had an interest in understanding and better getting, you know, my head around it a bit more. And so moving to the continent, what you'll find is it's not really as wildly sort of implemented and practiced, I think, at the caliber that you'll find in the US. And so I think for me, there was one, there was a curiosity around wanting to understand how it works so that, and really understanding it as a catalyzer and seeing the benefits it's had in the US and building the ecosystem. And then wanting to play a role in sort of building that same type of ecosystem on the continent and really driving, you know, capital and innovation into startups here. And, you know, when you look at historically, startups in Africa have raised the majority of their capital internationally. And so there was a interest as well to say, what can we be doing locally? What can we do as a continent to start really irrigating that pipeline and irrigating that ecosystem to drive startups from ideas, seed, all the way through to your Series A, B, and beyond, which is quite rare on this side of where we sit.
I think you're incredibly right. And I think FFA does an incredible job in sort of irrigating that pipeline, right? Through providing access and capital to founders of the continent. But in this early stage where you're focusing on seed to pre-series A, the risks revolve around the product, the market, and the team. Specific to the challenges of the African continent, how do you guide and navigate your portfolio companies around the intricacies of this early stage?
Yeah, that's a really good question. And so I think to sort of get into that, you know, from a Founders Factory point of view, we actually look at ourselves more of a venture development company rather than a venture capital. And so I think it's important to bring that out because we sort of hedge our investment with a level of makers lab and co-build support. And that's really driven by the insight that in the continent, most people will often tell you that, you know, capital is the widest issue. Yes, it is to some extent in that it's chasing very specific ideas and specific founders at certain stages, which often results in there's a bit of a misalignment in this ecosystem between where majority of the businesses sit, which is that pre-seed to seed stage, and where a lot of capital is chasing your growth to sort of pre-series A, series A, and beyond. And so at FFA, we kind of really designed the model with that insight in mind, knowing that we have to sort of hedge our investment in a capital with some level of co-build and development support to make sure that we're teaching and helping startups to, one, build the right products, right, and apply a good level of human-centered design and build, iterate, you know, discipline into their product building. Because right now, you know, we don't have a lack of capital in Africa and the lack of entrepreneurs and strong founders. We have sort of a deficit in investable businesses and products. And so we really try and fill that gap as well. I think it speaks to your earlier point around product being a core part of the risk area. So I think that's one area. And I think I share that because, you know, to answer your question around how we help startups navigate that, you know, startups who come into our program actually come in for that specific reason, the viewpoint that we can help them, one, through capital, which we, you know, consider to be an important catalyst, but we don't think it's the ultimate catalyst. And so we pair that capital with product design engineering investments, you know, typically all the things a startup usually needs but can't afford. And in fact, most of the time they're raising money to go and hire somebody to build that stuff for them. And so in a nutshell, that's how our business model sort of hedges around that risk, in that we have a group of like 40 to 60 experts across, you know, all those disciplines, engineering, design, product, you know, investments, compliance and ops, that effectively become, you know, the team for the startups that we bring in. So we often make the joke that a founder's factory, you know, when you come in, you grow your team by like 45 people, because it's not that we then literally do the work for you, because that equally doesn't set them up to win, but we then partner with their counterparts within their business to really help them, whether it's design or architecture, figuring out what the issues are with the business and really making sure we're then building a really strong pathway to scale. We apply OKRs and sort of monthly sprint approach. And so we also believe in this sort of design, iterate and test and validate model, rather than the old build it and they will come. So I think we try and manage that risk through our investment thesis.
I think you're spot on in terms of how venture development is so multidimensional outside of capital. And it's really about the value add outside of capital and what we can really bring across disciplines to the companies, right? And as the head of the scale venture of FFA, how do you effectively screen and qualify startups? Specifically, what are the most important metrics or the ones that get you excited that you use to gauge the performance of the startup?
Yeah, that's a really good question. And especially just because, as we all know, you know, seed investing, I would argue, is probably more art than science at a certain level. And like when you're like more at like series B or C, where, you know, you've got, you know, 18, 24 months of worth of historicals, you can build really strong models and extrapolate growth and behavior and trajectory from that. At seed, it's a lot more nuanced, right? And so, you know, I'd love to say we have a specific, you know, criteria that you have to tick every box and that's the only way you get in. But I'd say for me, there's about three or four things we look at really. One, you know, quality of the founding team is so important. I mean, I don't know if the name gave it away, we're called Founders Factory. We really, you know, focus on the founders. Founders are a really big deal. And when you look at startups that have, you know, stood the test of time, you know, founders really drive innovation. Teams build companies, you know, companies are just a collection of humans really. And so we pay a lot of time unpacking the humans behind the idea and really understanding the drivers behind why they've chosen that specific idea to work in, understanding, you know, the passion or domain expertise behind, you know, choosing the idea. And again, for us, we apply this quite intentionally to say, you know, why have you chosen this idea to work on? Because typically as a founder, as anyone, you know, you have a million ideas and then something tells you to hone into that one. So we focus a lot on the quality of the founding team, you know, and I think that's quite common across the world. But in Africa, especially, you know, we also interrogate the team for network and understanding who you have in your bandwidth, who you have in sort of your chest to actually catalyze you towards growth. And that's really important here because, you know, Africa does not have a shortage of problems, as I'm sure you can imagine. And also, you know, the most lucrative problems to solve are the ones that a lot of people are trying to solve for. And so the first thing we look at is the quality of the founding team to get a sense of, you know, what's their approach to solving that problem. And then equally, the defensibility around how they're choosing to solve that problem. And so for us, defensibility takes few lenses effectively. That could be anything from your tech stack, your product design, your, you know, first mover advantage, or maybe your network. Like if you're so-and-so's uncle, son is mayor of whatever, like, you know, that is something we actually weight in our I know it's not cool to say that, but I think it's the same in the US and anywhere you go, right? Like networks open doors. I think the second thing we look at is sort of the quality of the problem you're solving. Again, as shared, problems are, you know, a dime a dozen. And so we really pay attention to the intrinsic problem you're solving, the sustainability around the solution, the size of the opportunity or the problem, if you will. And really pay a lot of time unpacking that opportunity set. And then we look at, obviously, I think, you know, size of market is a part of that, right? If you're solving the right problem here, in theory, that means you should have a lot of people who are experiencing that, which inherently becomes the size of market. And then I think the fourth piece we look at, especially from a founder's factory point of view, as you know, we're corporate backed, and so really excited to be backed by two of the leading corporates. And so the fourth piece for us, which is why we actually chose a corporate backed model, right, is about raising smart capital. And when we say smart capital, you can easily go out to market, raise a fund like everyone else, get a bunch of LPs. Doesn't mean they don't have network and can open things, but we figured, from an African point of view, you really need to work with corporates and people who can actually catalyze opportunity for startups. And so for us, we leverage our corporate investors not only from a capital point of view, but also then, when you look at the core barriers to scale with any startups, it's usually access to distribution, access to networks. If you're super early, it's getting, those first few customers is super hard. People don't realize, getting to 100 customers is so hard. And so we leverage our corporates for those early stage pilots. We leverage them for expertise, like the idea that, the head of a bank can listen to your idea as a founder and tell you actually, oh my God, this is a waste of time, go do something else. Most founders have to learn that the hard way in some cases. And so having that access to experts who can, drive design and drive roadmap is really critical as well. And so I'd say it's those four things where we look at the founding team, quality of the problem they're solving for, market, size and opportunity set, and then looking at corporate and distribution synergy as well.
Incredible insights, and I think founders that are listening to the show right now can really carve out actionable strategies from what you've just said. You mentioned that one of the core pillars of FFA is to bridge access to capital and support for founders of the continent, and in that same vein, that you're actually quite bullish about the potential of the continent, right, to either match or even surpass the volume and value of VC deals in the US. Inherent to the geography or the culture of the continent, what kind of potential do you see specifically?
Yeah, absolutely. Africa is incredibly, incredibly talented and incredibly diverse as well. And I'm sure the same with Asia. Sometimes, the world will sort of apply this homogenous kind of brush to everyone. We're a diverse continent, 54 plus countries, several hundred dialects, and each one very nuanced in its markets, its people, its traditions, its cultures, its innovation. And so for us, with a team, with almost 80, 90% of us either, definitely being African, either having started a startup somehow or having worked in one, we are all sort of builders and inherently, passionate about the work we do. And so, I think the thing people don't realize where on the continent, one, I often say this as well, that I don't think, risk for African entrepreneurs is priced very fairly. I mean, by the time you meet a founder here who's actually, started something, the level of hurdles they've had to pass, we struggle with electricity, there's food, there's so much that they have to get to the point where you can even raise capital. And so the thing that we, for one, for us, that people miss is that, seed investing in Africa is survival business, whereas seed investment in America or Asia goes to product development. So I think those are really important nuances to bring to the front, that there's a strong sense of founder resilience here that I think the continent doesn't get enough credit for. And I think we're beginning to see that, change, as and you're seeing a lot of higher ticket sizes, Series A rounds, which, sounds really small from a US or Asia point of view, but most people wouldn't realize that in Africa, getting double digit, and I'm talking 10, 15 million, not like huge double digits, has been quite, low here. And so, our Series A to B, for example, would probably be even pre-seed or seed in an American startup, and then just gives you the variance in what people invest in. And so I think there's a really strong founder resilience on the continent. I think we also have a really strong, especially across Nigeria, Ghana, East Africa, even to some extent, SADC, a really strong education system that people don't realize and again give the continent credit for. And you'll go to the US and you look at some of the leading stats from, diaspora and people who drive and graduate from Harvards and your Stanfords. We have a huge volume of those graduates coming from African countries who have obviously been educated here and have gone elsewhere to follow on education. So I think there are strong founding qualities and intrinsics that founders have here, as I'd say is the first one. The second one is, the opportunity set, right? on top of not only have a strong founder community, we have one of the youngest populations on the planet. And so the market opportunity in Africa is significant, and it's why you're seeing so much, you know, global capital start to make its way here. And I think the hardest bit has been this lack of transparency. So big issues that, you know, investors sat in Asia or anywhere else are have sat there and thinking, oh my God, I'd love to actually participate in the African ecosystem, but are like, oh my goodness, I have no way, like I have nowhere how to start. I wouldn't even know how to do DD. So part of what we even try and do as a Founders Factory team is we're working with global networks and venture capitals as sort of that DD, trusted DD partner that starts to build a lot more transparency into the market, a lot more transparency into the ecosystem, and a lot more transparency into how this whole ecosystem works so that we're able to drive those valuations and drive capital this way. So I'd say the second piece is a huge market opportunity, right? And then the third is a lot of the misconception around, you know, there's obviously all the things we see, there's poverty, there's you know, a whole bunch of these stereotypes that we come across, and those are very real. But at the same time, you have an incredible time in history, I think, when you look at the US and you look at COVID and you look at where we are and this move towards, you know, people of color and driving more founding capital towards founders of color and, you know, seeing that time in history. And so I think there's something to be said around the time of history that we're living in that makes Africa really attractive as well as a as an investment destination outside of the intrinsics that most people will have. And so as a team, you know, I resigned, moved back home, left, you know, a very well-paying aerospace job to move back to the continent to pursue what I do now. And so we are very bullish. And I think the insight we actually have around a lot of this is part of the problem that you find in Africa, right, is the fact that there are not enough investable businesses. And so for us, by investing in a sort of venture development model, what we're starting to do with that is really solve for those issues that help strengthen and build that ecosystem, right? Because it's not that founders in America or Asia, I would argue, are any smarter or any better than African founders. It's the opportunities that they're awarded, right? When you meet an American founder or an Asian founder at seed stage, there's so much, you know, resource and investment already into that one founder that puts them way ahead of their African counterpart. And so part of what we're saying is that if you actually solved for that delta in support and ecosystem in the same way American ecosystems have it and European ecosystems have it, the same should apply in Africa, right? That if you start to solve for that delta and co-build and help startups actually learn the basics around things, you'll begin to see stronger products come to market that we believe can actually scale globally.
Yeah, I agree very much. And it's really about equal access to opportunity, right? And I think this segues very nicely into impact investment, because we're talking about the kinds of social impact that we want to create. And I know this is a topic that you're incredibly passionate about, right? At the same time, I feel that it'd be kind of remiss to talk about social impact without speaking about what's been happening over the past month. And at this point, I do want to have a very necessary conversation with you about the current global reckoning of racial inequality that's been catalyzed by the events in the United States. We're sparking active discussion on the topic of race, right, with areas like Eurocentric beauty, the impact of colonialism on education today. Through this lens, how does impact investment relate and contribute in enacting positive change in racial equality?
Oh man, that is the million-dollar question. And there are so many different vehicles that I think, if applied correctly, could actually drive and help solve a lot of what's going on. You know, you've said quite a lot there, so I'll try and unpack it as much as I can. So I think to start, I think to even get started before we even apply a solution to it, people need to really get a good sense of the problem, because I think what you're starting to see globally is that, you know, it's now made headlines again, because literally the world had to watch someone's life leave them over a video very casually. And I don't know if you watched that George Floyd video, but it for me was one of the most, you know, glaring and most just shocking things I've seen in a very long time. And not because as Black people, we haven't seen the senseless killing and continuous violence against us. I mean, this is why I say for me, this is not a new issue, right? We come, if you're going to apply an American lens, it's 400 years of slavery that was supposedly ended with civil rights, but we also know that that didn't, with the 13th Amendment, it meant the criminalization of that, which was a new form of slavery. You know, you watch documentaries like 13th on Netflix by Ava DuVernay, who really unpacked that really well. And so what you know is there is a real trend, and not even a trend, there's a real thread of systemic racism that has existed for a very long time. And I think obviously watching George Floyd's video, I think was one of those catalysts to say, you know, enough is enough. And it's a shame that we have to continue to get to these points for people to actually drive change. And so I think that's the first thing to make sure is well understood, that racism is not new, and systemic racism more especially. For me, the thing that really stood out about that video, and I think is speaking to the outrage right now, is just the casualness of how he was killed. You literally watched a police officer with two others next to him with their hands in their pockets. It's just another sunny day, with his neck, with his knee on someone's neck for 8 minutes and 46 seconds. And I think for me, that speaks to this issue of real inequality, where the lives of Black people do not matter at the same level of lives of white or other. And so I think that's the first thing to say, because, you know, with Black Lives Matter, there are always those who come out and are talking about all lives matter. Of course, all lives matter. We know that. And it's not having Black Lives Matter at the forefront, right, doesn't come against that. It's just saying, clearly, if you can do that in live video and you've done it for hundreds of years, you know, it shows that Black lives don't have the same weight as other lives. And then I think that's the first thing to bring to the fore. To get to your point then around, is impact investing, how can impact investing play a role in solving some of this, or VC? You then have to unpack the second problem set, right, which is the actual identity of capital and the identity of money and how money has come about. You know, without going into the science and theory of it, because we don't have enough time, when you look at actually the development of capitalism as a system, right, again, speaking to the systemic issues, it trickles all the way down to impact investing and venture capital, right? It money, people invest in people who look like them. It's this idea of meritocracy versus meritocracy. And so inherent in that is, you see it in the way money chases deals, whether it's in the US or the UK or anywhere else. People invest in people that look like them, sound like them, and come from the same regions as they do. And so when you then compound that with being in Africa, right, where in theory, the world is dollar-based, right? Well, it's not in theory, it actually is. And when you actually unpack why the world is dollar-based, right, you can chase it down to Bretton Woods, where it's a group of few white men who sat in a room and decided this is the way the world was going to work. Obviously, that's oversimplifying it. I understand World War II, there's a lot going on. But at the crux of it, it wasn't some, you know, crazy equation of getting someone to the moon. It was literally a decision, and it worked in the benefit of the US. And so the world was then dollar-based for no other complicated or, you know, intuitive reason than that. And so when you actually unpack that, then you realize that the whole world is actually denominated under the dollar, which means from an African point of view, you actually are part of a system that you don't contribute to, that does not respect you, that has no, you don't have a seat at the table, right? And so the third piece then becomes, these ideologies or these decisions create systems, right? And one of which is capitalism and venture capital. And so when you're then sat in Africa looking to raise capital to grow your idea, the first thing you come across is the way money works, right? Money is Western. And that doesn't mean it's a bad thing or a good thing. It just is. And so it's looking for Western sounding ideas, Westernized founders, and who will speak and say a certain way. And which is why you've seen it be so hard to have venture capital in Africa for a really long time. Not because we don't have, you know, our own ideas to invest in. We just don't have the capital to do so. And that money comes from global investors who have mandates that they then impose, that sometimes in most cases make it almost impossible to deal flow here in the way that you would see anywhere else. And some of that is to the quality of the deals, but some of that is very much designed. And so when you then get to the third lens, which is around impact investing, right, which is also just a set of tools to deploy capital and support. And I would look at the same around venture capital, if you like, unpack the titles. They're inherently both about putting resource into a business with a view that, or an idea or a problem, with a view that you will, one, catalyze that growth, solve the problem, and hopefully in the case of VC, and in some cases even impact investing in its truest form, where, you know, returns and impact are not mutually exclusive, you know, you're getting some level of commercial return, which comes with certain mandates you have to fulfill. You know, impact investing, I think, is a great industry and methodology, and one that I'm super, you know, passionate about. But when you look at, actually, an article was written about 2-3 years ago, and you look at where impact investing money has gone in Africa, sadly, majority of it, less than 1%, has actually been invested in, you know, founders of color, if you can believe that, where I say founders who are actually African in Africa building certain solutions. It actually, majority of it has gone to expat-led founded Africa businesses that are in Africa, that are operating in Africa, doing absolutely amazing work. And so for me, this is not, again, saying impact investing is bad or that's a bad thing. But I think it's also important to unpack the tool and the reality of how it's being implemented before we either decide it's going to help or not. Because I think in theory, right, you would think that impact investing would have done really good work, right? But unfortunately, again, the capital and deployment of it has been skewed towards, you know, intermediaries and, you know, organizations that are not necessarily founded by locals, but more so, you know, international and expat organizations. And that's not a bad thing, but I think it speaks to why I had to unpack the problem to say, you know, the money has mandates and it has to, you know, they're going to invest in entities and people who feel and look familiar. And that's not necessarily a bad thing, but I think it's just something worth recognizing.
No, Luazi, I appreciate very much that you're unpacking this, because like what you just said, impact investment is really just one tool and one lens to tackle this really multidimensional, multifaceted issue, right? And in that same vein, your work in the past is really about democratizing access to opportunity. And I think that's incredibly meaningful. How exactly have you been able to address these gaps in access to capital, knowledge, and markets?
Yeah. That's a really good point. And I think one thing I want to highlight is I have not solved it completely. I think the work continues and, you know, we try and do that every day. Poverty is not an IQ issue. It's an access issue. It's access to knowledge. It's access to capital and it's access to markets, right? That's the equalizer. It's the access to these things. And what America and the rest of sort of the first world has done is really master that access opportunity for its citizens and people. And so when you look at Africa, our problem is not a lower IQ, right? It's the fact that we don't have access to these things. And so the work for me became, how do I then create solutions or work in environments or work with people who are solving for the bottlenecks around those three points, which is knowledge, capital, and markets. And really, that's kind of how I've sort of structured my career all the way from, you know, starting in aerospace to the work that we do now at Founders Factory, but also, you know, my own startup, which is called HQ, which is, you know, a social capital market for solving for the exact same thing, but focusing on female founders of color and female founders on the continent. And so that's really where I focus the work on. And so when you look at what we do today, you know, the access to knowledge, really trying to help entrepreneurs learn how to build strong businesses, learn how to, you know, learn what venture capital is, learn, you know, understand a cap table, understand, you know, legal 101 to be able to know how to actually not give away your business at the beginning so you can own it at the end. Like, these things probably sound so basic to people sat where you are or anywhere else in the world, but there's a huge knowledge gap here around your startups and how that whole ecosystem works. And so I've spent a lot of time, and we all do as a team, even at the factory, you know, really solving for that knowledge gap. And it speaks to the model that we use as well, where we couple capital with development and Makers Lab, where a lot of that comes with knowledge sharing and expertise and you know, co-building with our founders. And then the second piece is really the capital piece, right? When you look at, you know, venture capital in 2017 or 2018, you know, in Africa, and don't quote me because they vary so much. But I think you look at 2018 in Africa, there was about $500 million raised in VC over 2018 over like 138 to 140 deals. You compare that to the US, which raised almost 80 billion over like countless deals. So you have to ask yourself, like, what's the difference between, you know, a whole continent raising less than $1 billion or half a billion versus one country that can raise, you know, tens of billions in the same year? And what is really driving that, right? And so you start to see that discrepancy in capital, right? Which, as you can imagine, drives a lot of the discrepancy in deals and scale and growth and entrepreneurship and just economic viability of the continent. When we actually unpacked that capital gap, right, what we found was, again, I think I've touched on this a bit earlier, the notion that, you know, American and other founders, they aren't raising or attracted that kind of capital because they're somewhat superior beings or, you know, super intelligent. It's really because by the time they start a business, they have so much support and an ecosystem, whether it's education, it's talent, it's networks, it's build support, where they're able to get to very strong MVPs way earlier than the African counterpart. And so what happens is you're not able to raise as much capital because you don't have enough of an investable product. And so the work that we do effectively, literally is why Founders Factory exists, is we built a model to start closing that gap. Why? Because we know that once you close that gap and you strengthen build, you strengthen knowledge, you create stronger founders, the hypothesis is you'll have stronger businesses in market, which should attract more capital. Because we don't have a capital issue in Africa. We have a build and product and business issue. And so if you can solve for that, you know, capital chases good deals. And if there are good deals to be found, there will be capital. And so, and then the third piece is the market piece, right? And so, you know, at a very basic level, Founders Factory is one creating markets for businesses, right? When you look at, you know, in America, they have the opposite problem to what we have. So in America, the markets and are so saturated, right? So you're having to develop products and the launch space or the market sizes are so saturated that you just have to compete at such high levels and volumes and crazy returns models where they're no longer profitable to even be in business because the market is so saturated. Whereas in Africa, you know, our problem is the opposite. Like the market is too big, like the opportunity is too wide. And so part of even the work we do with founders is to actually raise their thinking to say, hey, like you are thinking too small, like this business could actually become a unicorn. And you know, in Founders Factory for us, this is why we say we're not a typical accelerator. For us, we are only here to find and build unicorns. Like we're going to be the stereotype that says there are no unicorns out of Africa. We're actually on a mission to make sure that is proven and done eventually. And really it's creating those markets. It's actually, you know, in literal sense, there are startups who come to us with no customer, very little customers, being able to, through our corporates, create that very first customer base that then opens them up to the rest of the continent and allows for a level of visibility as well. Because that's the other issue is there are tons of these startups, but if no one knows you exist, no one can actually transact with you. And so we really focus on solving for those all three throughout my time at FFA and also through my own company, HQ as well.
Of course. And there are three things that I want to chime in on. First is that you raised a lot of valid points about poverty, right? Which I agree very much on, in the sense that at the core of poverty, it's about access, it's about privilege, it's about how you've been able to have access to opportunities that others haven't had in the first place. The second thing is you mentioned in 2018, African startups garnered around 500 million, right, in funding. In 2019, you know, I'm sure you saw as well, it increased to a figure of around a billion. And I think this is, you know, this significant increase is quite attributable to the work and the mission that you're on, right? Along with all the passionate people in the continent as well. And I think that's incredible. Third thing is you talked about your own startup, HQ. How do you think we can further champion for diversity and equal opportunity?
The first place is to start with a diversity in capital management and capital ownership. Just because when you look at who owns funds and who leads these LPs, there's a wider ratio of men and white men who run those funds. And so therefore, it's not a surprise when you hear that, you know, hundreds of billions of venture capital raised each year, only 2% of like 100 billion goes to women founders, and only 0.02% of that goes to women of color founders. You know, those are not coincidences. Those are not mistakes. It's actually designed to be that way, right? So I think the first way to solve it is let's diversify who owns money and what money looks like, and let's get that spread. And for me, diversity doesn't just mean gender or sex or color. It means, you know, diversity is a good thing. It's not some plug that people should think of that is good PR, but it's actually because the diversity of thought brings, you know, stronger, you know, investment thesis. I was reading a TechCrunch article yesterday from one of the fund managers at Saka or something, and he was sharing that he missed out on a really big deal, like a really good deal that has now exited. It was a you know, male grooming startup. I think it's not Breville or something, but like a male grooming startup that was founded by two African-American founders. And he paused on that deal initially because he just didn't understand it. And he was just like, this makes no sense. And what has now happened is it's just gone and exited. And obviously he missed out on that. And what I loved about that is his transparency to say, had he had, you know, African-Americans on his own team or like at that level, somebody could have said, actually, in the African-American community, this is a huge opportunity. Let's put money into it because you now have a diversity of thought and understanding. So unless we diversify capital and who owns those decisions, we're not going to make the change we need. I think the second piece is also, you know, us as women taking more ownership as well to show up to opportunities. And I think there are so many other sort of nuanced reasons why women don't participate as much in VC and businesses. I mean, right now, actually, since this Black Lives Matters movement started, we've seen almost 50% increase in female founders, like women, Black female founders starting startups. So we're seeing that women start startups at a faster rate than males, but for whatever reason, they don't go beyond scale. Like they don't hit the scale and hit the Series B and onwards. And so we know that they have good ideas, they have good seed stage businesses, but for whatever reason, they don't go beyond that. And you know, there's a lot of psychology and tradition and nuance built into that, which we can unpack in another day. But I think there's an opportunity for women to, you know, either take a seat at these tables and start to play more evident role in the market, or, you know, I'm actually of the opinion that we should be creating our own tables. And I'm trying to pioneer that through HQ to say, you know, we've been begging for a seat at these tables for ages. And I think if you look at the maths, you know, women are the majority of the population. Like we own, you know, majority of the decisions around where capital goes. We're not sat at the C executive level, but, you know, middle management and corporations. In our households, women make the decisions on where money goes. We've seen that, you know, a McKinsey report showed that actually women-run businesses are a lot more fiscally responsible and at an absolute value actually, you know, have higher returns than our male counterparts. But unfortunately, we don't get the capital to actually bring those businesses forward. And so I think there's an opportunity for women to start leveraging ourselves as customers to actually get that done.
Yep. And with diversity of culture, right, it brings about the diversity of thoughts, opinions, and ideas. And if we're able to harness that kind of immense potential of these diversified ideas, then we're able to really push the needle forward. And these are certainly necessary conversations to have, no matter what kind of profile or sector we are. And so I do want to end this episode today by giving you a little explanation of what the podcast title is, right? Scalescape. And it's an obvious combination of scale and scape. And the fusion of these words, right, stems from the importance of accounting for the landscape or the bigger picture when you're scaling a company, like the location, demographic, geography, and other sociocultural factors. Right. So my question is to end this episode is, what is one tip that you can give to founders today to scalescape their companies towards success?
Ooh, That's a yummy one. That's a really interesting one because I love the notion of obviously linking scale to landscape. And because I think the two are so inextricably linked that you kind of have to. I think it's not new advice. I think it's not new tips. I would say one, just start with what you have, get in the arena and build something. And then the second I would say is really focus on solving a really important problem and a lucrative problem and a scalable problem. Like, it doesn't help the world for you to go and create more, jam jars or glasses or like pens. Like, there is enough of them. Yes, you will meet someone somewhere in the Amazon who might not have a pen and might need one, but I would say, it's not your problem to solve.
Okay, well, there you have it. Luazi, thank you so much for taking time out of your busy schedule to do this today. We've been trying so hard to get this to work, and I'm so glad that we've been able to because I learned so much. And I'm really looking forward to having more conversations in the future. So once again, I really appreciate it. Thank you so much.
No, thank you. And congratulations on getting this started. It's so cool to have awesome voices like yourself in the market and really a pleasure and an honor on my side to be a part of it. I hope it was worth your listeners' time.
I hope you enjoyed this episode of Scalescape today. If you would like to engage with the content of the podcast more, check out medium.com/@scalescape for show notes and resources. That's medium.com/@scalescape. See you next week.